You're listening to Red Eye on the Rabble Podcast Network. My name is Peter Royce, and I encourage you to support Rabble during their 2009 winter fundraising campaign. Go to rabble.ca to find out how.
Polls have indicated that Canadians don't want their soldiers in Afghanistan, nor do Americans want their troops there. And certainly Afghans do not want to be occupied. Yet President Obama has pledged to double U.S. troop support. 30,000 more soldiers will arrive this month. A forum was held in Vancouver last week to discuss what anti-war activists can do to resist this escalation. StopWarBlog.ca editor Dave Markland spoke at the forum.
At the moment, there are Pentagon plans to increase the troops levels there by some 20 or 30,000 more troops. And the State Department may have other ideas. That's Hillary Clinton's junket. And Obama himself recently committed to reviewing the entire Afghan war process before making any further decisions. So it's really unclear what the trajectory is going to be as far as the announced surge. It's still open for public input. Public pressure could easily be a deciding factor in whether or not that surge takes place and other things about the course of the war. Most strategic analysts that are looking at the possibility of this surge, many of them very pro-war, in general, they're quite skeptical of it, if not outright dismissive. Most of them feel that the time for a surge in troops is long past. If they'd have put that many troops in the early days of the occupation, in 2002, then they might not have the problems that they have today, but that the problems of today are not going to be solved by these extra troops. And in fact, there has been a surge in Afghanistan. In 2007, there was a modest surge, what they called a mini surge of American troops chiefly. And the troops were increased by almost 50%. And the result was that insurgent violence increased by about 50%. So there's little reason to expect that any surge that might be coming in the near future will have any different results. One leading strategic analyst wrote in the Financial Times a few months back that the war in Afghanistan, or Afghanistan at the moment, resembles a surreal hunting estate in which the US and NATO breed the very terrorists which they then tracked down. And the results of that surge suggest that what might happen with a surge in the near future would be exactly the opposite of its stated aims. And that last troop surge actually resulted in a pullback of troops. Because of the increased violence, a lot of the NATO outposts and far-reaching areas in southern Afghanistan were shut down. Troops were moved in closer to their main bases. So Canada moved out of Shahwali Kot district. It had been there from early on in their operation, but they pulled back, from other outposts as well. Just the other day, a New York Times dispatch noted that the reporter notes, in a recent visit, this reporter traveled Kandahar City for 5 days and did not see a single Canadian soldier on the streets. This is the area that Canadian soldiers are supposed to be chiefly concerned with, the populated areas of Kandahar, starting with Kandahar City, and then the Panjwai district, also a densely populated area. That's sort of a tenet of the ink spot strategy. The ink spot strategy attempts to win over the population by providing security in a sort of ever-growing concentric circles around populated areas. So starting chiefly Kandahar City, Panjwai, Zari district, the main populated areas. And from there, they were going to spread throughout those populated areas and then to the less and less populated areas. And like I said, it looks like it's gone in reverse with the addition of more troops. The other development worth noting is that locals are not in support of this occupation anymore. It's arguable that they were for quite a few years there, actually in support of these foreigners who were occupying their country, hoping against hope that it might produce good results this time. But now they're beginning to see the folly in that opinion. James Ferguson, an experienced foreign affairs journalist, reported from Afghanistan recently, quote, "It's all over. We've lost the consent of the people. It's finished." Sonali Kulhatkar, one of the leading observers of the Afghan scene and certainly the situation of women there. She works out of California but does support work for RAWA. And she recently surmised that the bulk of the Afghan population will be happy if NATO and U.S. troops left the country. And more media reports are commenting on this, that common Afghan opinion has changed. And there's real opposition to this occupation now. And the reasons for this opposition are well known. Bombing of civilians. Just on the blog, just looking at the news reports in English that I could find over the last 8 months, and I've compiled them, comes out to almost 700 dead civilians. That's by us. It's, you know, Western troops. That's not Taliban. Almost 700 in just, since the beginning of July. If you take into account that most civilian casualties aren't reported to authorities in Iraq, it looks like the rate might have been 1/10 of them would be reported. Then you can see that maybe just in the last 8 months, we've killed perhaps thousands of people. That's directly. Indirectly, civilians who can't get to hospitals during for childbirth or things like that. Indirect deaths are probably, you know, absolutely massive. In general, the media coverage just shows that Westerners just don't care about Afghans. There'll be credible reports of multiple civilian casualties quite frequently in the English language press in the world, and they're not picked up. Nobody talks about them. No commentary on it whatsoever. Today, I think the accusation is 22 dead civilians in Laghman province, not too far from Kabul. It'll be interesting to see if anybody even talks about that. This popular resistance opposition to the occupation is also caused by our house invasions. Many Afghans are highly disturbed by the nature of the house invasions, which keep going on against even the regulations that the Karzai government has asked foreign troops to put into place so that Western troops will go in by themselves without Afghans even present, as is sort of the expectation. And a lot of these house invasions are done by special forces. And special forces are being almost completely not talked about, left out of the media entirely, because to report on them means that you might get a forced exit from Afghanistan. At least one Toronto Star reporter was sent home after just mentioning special forces presence. You're just not allowed to write about them, not allowed to talk about them. And it looks like almost for certain Canadian special forces are involved in these operations. The UN special rapporteur on the subject last year, who went to Afghanistan to examine extrajudicial killings in Afghanistan, found took very seriously reports that foreign special forces are doing nighttime raids with bayoneting of civilians, including children. One report out of Helmand province says, pretty much a My Lai-style massacre had occurred in November of 2007, I believe. The British Army said that they were taking those reports seriously at the time. And the special rapporteur went on to, again, treat this evidence very seriously, and he gathered more evidence. And what he noted about the Canadian government and their role in this is that they were not even forthcoming with his questions, which he said, in his mind, that Canada was shirking its legal responsibilities, that Canada is legally required to tell, his name was Alston, Philip Alston, I believe, to tell him what is going on with their special forces, and they were just mum about it. And locals are beginning to support the Taliban, believe it or not. And that comes from the most pro-Western of sources. Gene McKenzie, who runs the Institute for War and Peace Reporting in Afghanistan. So she teaches Afghans to be reporters. And it's funded by the Soros Open Society Institute, if I recall, and other liberal sources that everybody's understandably suspicious of. But even her, she's been there for 2 or 3 years now, one of the most experienced people in rural areas. She goes to Helmand a lot, goes to a lot of the rural areas, which is key. Most journalists never get out of the cities, and it's very different in Afghanistan. It's hard to imagine a country that's more different from city to country than Afghanistan. And in her reportings, she says that even in the cafes of Kabul, where, of course, the most westernized pro-Western and modernized population would hang out, even there you'll hear open talk about that the Taliban are a legitimate national liberation movement. This is what she reports. And all sorts of other journalists are reporting too lately that more and more Afghans are finding the Taliban to be a legitimate and supportable movement. Shocking, but nonetheless true. So at this point, it looks like Karzai will be shown the door. The Obama administration doesn't have any love for him. Excuses are abounding. The corruption, of course, his brother is one of the leading drug kingpins in Kandahar province. Incompetency, apparent mental illness, a lot of the rumors go. And his recent defiance, where he is using the dead civilians as sort of political capital, trying to make himself look independent of the American occupation. But it looks like he'll be going, probably for the main reason is that he's just a Bush appointee. He was handpicked by Zalmay Khalilzad, who is one of the leading neoconservatives and an Afghan himself. So Karzai is probably too tainted by the Bush legacy to expect to continue. And he'll make a nice scapegoat as well, so that the Obama administration, if they choose to, can get a fresh start, a new president and a new lease on life for the occupation, perhaps. And that brings us to what we might expect from the future then. Several days ago, four prominent Afghans visited Washington, D.C., in what U.S. officials are calling the dream ticket for the upcoming elections this year and next year in Afghanistan. So somebody to replace Karzai. In the past, there was really no viable alternative to Karzai, so most people thought he would stay. But this new dream ticket of Afghan politicians who were previously at each other's throats looks like it might be the new future for Afghanistan. And these four, three of whom speak fluent English, they're Gulaga Sherzai. I assume he doesn't speak fluent English. He's a warlord from Kandahar province. Abdullah Abdullah, from the Northern Alliance, if you remember them. He was their foreign affairs representative, so he had good connections with Iran and Russia. And that's instructive for what the future holds in Afghanistan, and it's a reminder of how powerful Russia and Iran still are there, worth considering for thinking of what a more decent future for Afghanistan would look like. Also, Ashraf Ghani, who's a Western-style bureaucrat, again, spent a lot of time in the West. And Ali Ahmad Jalali is now hat-tipped to be the next president. Jalali has been a U.S. citizen since 1987. He's a military historian, teaches in Washington, D.C. He's written a couple of respected military histories of especially the Russian occupation of Afghanistan. I'm probably getting toward the end of my time, so I'll just read to you a few things that Jalali, this man who's expected to be the next president of Afghanistan, things that he said in the press in the last several years, and they probably make the case better than I can that the war there is, the nature of the war there is much different than what we're sold. Jalali said, most surveys claim that only 10% of the people of Afghanistan are fighting for the Taliban and 20% are fighting for the government, that is that they favor the government over the Taliban, while 70% are sitting on the fence. This was almost a year ago, I think, when he said that. And it might have been quite true. A lot of journalists reported that most people were unsure about who they supported and just wanted things to get normal again, and they would support anybody that would make things normal for them. On the nature of the Taliban, the enemy that we're fighting, Jalali again says, only 20% of insurgents who form the core of the Taliban are fighting the ideological war. The rest are aggrieved tribes who have been mistreated by some government officials or drug trafficker or some foreign intelligence operators or by transnational Al-Qaeda terrorists. It also consists of unemployed youth and criminal groups. And it's worth reflecting on that most of the Taliban fighters are unemployed men, young men, and many of them with no ideological axe to grind, whereas we're told that the Taliban form a sort of the second head to an Al-Qaeda Taliban offensive on the world. Most Taliban leaders haven't shown much interest in worldwide jihad. Their interests are more local, more national. And there's an argument to be made that the Taliban is becoming more and more of a national liberation movement, taking on everybody that opposes the U.S.-led occupation. And it also, his comments also point out that, in another way of looking at things, if they're not a national liberation movement, well, we're also, it can be argued, we're on one side of a civil war. So all those fighters that are fighting against us because of tribal rivalries, and that somehow one tribe got, you know, curried favor with the occupation, and the other side automatically opposes them. That's weighing in on one side of a civil war, and history shows us that that's extremely dangerous and a situation, and we can only expect disaster if that's the case. Wrapping up then, this war began as a blatantly illegal war. Bush was pointed about that. He didn't want the United Nations involved. He wanted to show American power in its sort of naked, vengeful glory. And it continues to be illegal. You can't start something illegally and then suddenly make it legal by a few UN Security Council resolutions, which there have been, but it only sort of papers over the original crime. It's a war that's been highly unpopular throughout all of the countries, save one, who are contributing troops, and the one exception, the US, that's changing now too. I haven't seen any really good polls on it, but the ones that came out in the last half of 2008 that were mostly regional show that the American population was changing their opinion from it being a good war in Afghanistan to something else, whereas the rest of troop-committing countries have been pretty opposed to it since early on in their commitment of troops. Canada, soon after 2006 anyway, had about 55% of people opposed to our participation there, and that continues. Australia started a little lower than that, and it's now they're more opposed to the war than we are. Britain, very much more opposed to the war. Poland, extremely opposed to the war. Their soldiers have committed an outrage, an atrocity, so it's probably understandable, and on and on. And in Afghanistan now, too. Opposition is growing. Support for our occupation has been hemorrhaging for some time. So armed with these simple truths, I think we have every reason to expect that that we can help end what is an awful, awful war being waged against the poorest people in the world. Thank you.